Hi everyone, I'm joined today by Loretta Doyle, who is obviously well known to many of our judo community. She's an eighth Dan, former world champion in 1982, former GB coach, former IJF commentator, board of director for the BJA. She's also a two-time European champion and a Commonwealth gold medalist. So welcome, Loretta.
Good evening, Ross, and good evening to anybody else that'll be out there listening.
Well, let's hope there are. this is my first time doing a podcast, so please do excuse anything that I'm doing wrong to anyone who's listening out there. The idea of these podcasts is to create an oral history of British judo, to speak to the various personalities within British judo, across all of British judo, and to gain an oral history. So the idea is this this podcast will go out. We will also take transcribed copy, which will be added to archives, hopefully for future generations to look on. So it's a big project, and it's one that hoping that we can have success with. But yeah, as I say, I'm delighted. So Loretta, basically, if I can just, I'm just going to ask you a few questions, and obviously, if you could just tell us, you know, as much as you can about each one. So, can you tell me where you were born?
Well, I was originally born. I was born in North London, Highbury, an Islington girl, a Gunner's favourite, and yes, born and bred there, and and had some wonderful moments and lots of friends. Still keep in touch with.
Fabulous. And what did your dad do, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, my dad was a man of many trades. He originally came over as a very young man, and I say a very young teenager, from Dublin, Ireland, not at the same time with my mother, who was also born in Dublin, but they both met in London. And when they were very young, and over nearly 60 years they were together. And my dad was a mechanic. He was a scaffolder. He was a long distance lorry driver. In those days, you did all the jobs you could possibly get to raise a large family. And so, very, very proud of him.
Very hardworking man, it sounds.
Oh, definitely. Even to this day, if the things that he's done throughout his life with supporting me, and he helped me build my home in the west coast of Scotland. And even now I'm in Birmingham and he's still tinkering away doing the DIY and keeping me right.
Fantastic. So how did you first get involved in judo? What was your journey to judo, so to speak?
Well, it was a little bit of chance, really, because as a nine-year-old, I was very hyperactive and the oldest of five children. So it was one of these things that would either drive my parents mad, especially my mum, because my dad doing a lot at that time, the long distance lorry driving. And so he was out of the house. So five kids and one bouncing off from one wall to another was very difficult for her. But my neighbour, she had started judo, and it so happened the judo club was actually in my primary school, so I was very familiar of the school there, but I didn't realize there was a judo club there. So I used to toddle along with my friend, and I turned up at the Highbury judo club, which was had two parts to it. Had a boys section and a girls section.
Of course.
And the girls was in Highbury quadrant, and the boys were in Highbury Grove, which was about a 10-minute walk apart. And it was a husband and wife club. And Shirley Ward was my instructor that looked after the girls, and her husband, John Ward, looked after the boys. And when I turned up, I was one of these very small nine-year-olds that at first it was, I think you're a little bit too small to start. So they wouldn't let me on the mat. And they surely decided that if I was that keen, I could still come along and watch. And I did for something like about 4 months. It was like a term, a school term, that I sat there, and I turned up twice a week on a Tuesday and a Friday to do judo and still not getting a crack at it. But I was taking it all in. I was keeping an eye on what they were doing it. And then eventually when I did get a chance, it was like duck to water. I was loving it. I was right in there and never stopped really.
Why do you think judo appealed to you? I mean, at nine, obviously, why do you think it was that you thought, you know, you say you kept coming back and watching it. Why was that, do you think?
It was because it was dynamic and it was engaging, and the girls were all together, and it's like when you're at school, you can sometimes be quite frustrated and looking for the physicality of something. And someone that was like myself, very hyper, and wanted to get physically involved in doing something. But sometimes you find if you're in a football club or you're in the netball, which being very small, I was never getting a chance of the ball. I was never good at kicking a ball. And when it came to tennis, I would just be the worst partner in the world. So a lot of different sports other than athletics, which I was very, very good at, I couldn't swim. So when it came to judo, I just felt that it was a bit of a natural transition into a physical activity that was very engaging, lots of fun, and met lots of friends with it. So it was a nice environment to be in.
So you obviously started at this school club run by the ward husband and wife team, as you mentioned. How long were you there for?
Gosh, I was there up until I was 15. And by that time, I was showing promise of being a really good competitive athlete. Not at the early stages. When I first started, I was sort of the first competition I went into. I think I must have been about 11. And I really wasn't prepared for it. I loved the idea of training. And then I went into a competition that I just most probably was a little bit, one, naive, but two, not physically equipped to take on. Sure. And got a bit of a bad experience and decided that, no, I was never going to ever compete again. That was my thought. I'm never going to do any competition. I'll go to the training club because I love that and I've got all my friends, but I am never going to compete. And I kept that going for about 2 years. But every time Shirley Ward would say, oh, there's a little competition coming up, I go, oh, no, I'm not doing that. I don't want to do that. So I never really wanted to compete until a team event that took place in my school. So I was representing at that time. I'd just gone into the senior school, coming up to 13. And we had this team event where I was representing the Barnsbury School for Girls. And it was a team of three. And I was the anchor, lost every match, but we got a bronze medal. And I thought I was world champion at that stage. I thought I've got a medal, but I never actually won a match. But I was part of a team, and that's really important.
Yes.
So for me, it was the first step of going back into competition. And I didn't really, I'd fought in the trials, I fought in the nationals, and I remember thinking, well, no, I'm telling a lie, I didn't fight in the nationals. I went straight into, I used to go to the training sessions, the national training sessions with Ellen Cobb. Now, I wasn't part of the team at that stage, but again, I just loved the training and I loved the idea of mixing with a lot of other young girls that were just as enthusiastic as I was. And it was just by chance once more. At 13 years of age, Ellen Cobb had spaces on her coach that used to take a coach load of young athletes across over to Germany and places like that. And at this time, I was able to have an opportunity to go over. Now, this was the first time I ever went outside the UK. So you can imagine, a 13-year-old, and I was so super excited about getting on a bus, which nowadays young athletes would turn around and go, oh, I'm not doing that if I'm not flying, sort of thing. But I was super excited about doing this and spending hours on a bus traveling across to Germany. And when I actually got there, we found out that I had to be 14. And right. I was just that little bit, I was just a few months too young. So, but because they've got 40 odd girls all going in this one tournament, I managed to slip through the net and was able to participate. But obviously, was I any risk? Possibly not, because at that time I wasn't expected to get any medals or anything like this. It was just being part of a team. So surprising to everybody, I ended up finding myself in the final and not realizing.
Wow.
So my first international event, I picked up a silver medal. Now, I remember the final as if it was like yesterday, because it was the first time I was ever introduced to arm locks and strangles. It was only ever hold down. So I didn't have a clue what an arm lock or a strangle was until I was on the receiving end of shimmywaza. And I got the fright of my life. And as soon as that collar went across for the shimmywaza, I was tapping straight away. I was like, oh no, that's not going to happen. So yeah, obviously, but I had already gone into that final totally exhausted, delighted that I'd got a medal. So it didn't matter for me at that stage what color it was. I just was delighted to be there. So that was my international career started by then, 13 years of age, first international, silver medalist, and raring to go. And then I actually might as well have said that was me wanting to be world champion. And it was like my world championships, that first competition.
Wow. So, yeah, so you'd gone from basically starting at 9 years old, obviously at the same club you said, and you know, you obviously got involved with Ellen Cobb, who Ellen Cobb Eighthdown, who obviously is a former international player herself. And then so at 15, you're obviously quite embedded, I presume, at that point in the sort of British junior scene. And where did you move to then? Which club did you move on to next?
Well, I then, unfortunately, obviously with the Highbury Judo Club, I'd said I'd like to just travel around, because I then felt that I just wanted to experience different clubs and different type of training methods. I'd also wanted different training partners. So it was one of those situations that I wasn't able to do both. Now, I'm quite sure at that time, well, reflecting back at the time, John and Shirley Ward most probably would have dealt with it in a different way. But at that time, it was an ultimatum. And yeah. I remember being disappointed, because I love my club and I still love the idea that I started my career at the Highbury Judo Club. John and Shirley Ward were kata. As much as they were judo teachers, they were kata champions as well. And the foundation that they had given me in my judo career is where I am today because of that. Mm. And I always say that, regardless the few hiccups that we had along the way at the earlier stages, to the point that when I did go to, I used to go to the Buddha Choir, I used to go to the LJS, the old Tokai, not the new one that we're down at London Bridge, but the old one where you used to rub shoulders with the likes of Brian. Now, this is going to show my age. I'm a little embarrassed now, but the Brian Jacks, the Neil Adams, the Renfrew, all those Olympic athletes in those days from the 70s onwards, they were all there. And I was just one of the very few women that used to go to these clubs, but I loved the atmosphere and watching all these world-class athletes training on one tatami together. And I'm there walking around in a daze with pigtails and just loving the lot of it and just soaking up. I was like a sponge. Yeah? I just watched and I learned and I just mirrored things that was happening there and then on the mat and experimenting. And from really 15 years of age, I didn't have a club and I didn't have a coach.
Right.
But I had a good foundation from John and Shirley Ward. So although it may seem a bit weird, but they gave me the tools to be able to just go out there and do the job in hand. And I just had to do a little bit of growing up in the world of competitive judo by traveling to all these clubs. And my father was, well, the glorified taxi driver, but he was someone that I trusted, and he gave me a lot of sensible advice. He never got actively involved in my coaching at all. He never told me, he never gave advice on the judo side of it. He was just there as moral support. And it went from there, really. It was trial and error. I used to go to the Tokai in the morning, and there maybe sometimes I'd be the only one there, and I would have maybe Chris Bowles that would turn up, and I would do some uchikomi with him, some crash mat work. And he would now and again, he would be take me around over the bridges, London Bridge and all that, shouting at me to keep running and that type of thing, because he was a very, very fit man in those days, but a lot of encouragement, but a lot of yelling as well. But yeah, and I trained the likes of Ray Stevens and Ray Neenans, all these, where a lot of people will be listening and going, who are they? But they were phenomenal athletes.
Absolutely.
As well as judo players. They are amazing judo players, very, very skillful athletes. So I was sort of mixing along with those type of athletes, but with like Billy No Mates, no club, no coach, but just a head on my shoulders and an opinion in my head, really, of where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do in my life.
Okay, I mean, so basically, so yeah, between 15, and we'll get to this, because obviously you made your debut at the inaugural World Championships in 1980 when you were 17. So when did you make your, or how did you get introduced to the senior British team? I mean, was that around that? It would have been around 1980, I imagine, or 1979 around then?
Well, it was a little bit earlier. I was just coming up to 16 because it was the British Senior National Championships, and which was held in June, and I was going to be 16 in July. So it was just before my 16th birthday that I decided. Well, I didn't decide. It was my mother that says, why aren't you fighting in the tournament at the weekend? I said, well, I'm too young, really, Mum. And she says, well, you're never too young. Come on, you might as well have a go. You never know what you're going to do unless you have a go. So it was literally the Thursday before the competition. And in nowadays, you wouldn't be able to do this. But it was a Thursday. And I phoned up Ellen Cobb and I said, Ellen, I would like to compete in the British Championships, Senior Championships, but I haven't put my entry in. I haven't got accommodation. I don't know where it is, but can I come? and that's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
So Ellen said, yes, right, of course, with that very deep voice. Yes, Loretta, of course you can come. No problem. I'll sort it out. So my mother and I got on a train, and I think I've got a funny feeling it was Huddersfield or somewhere like this, that we got on a train, and I remember it was really late. It could have been almost like midnight that we rocked up in this city, and I was competing the next day and phoning up Ellen when we arrived and said, we're here. So she managed to get us accommodation, and the next day I was competing in the under 52 kilo category. And in those days, there was, there was a few top international players that were competing. And I never had a chance at all of ever winning it at that stage. I just loved the idea of fighting. And it was one of these situations for many years in my early stage of my career is that, let's have a go. I've got nothing to lose, everything to gain, nothing to lose. It's a bit of experience. And that's how I went into competitions at a very young age. It didn't bother me who they were. If I won, it was something I've achieved. If I lost, well, no one really expected me to win in the first place. That was my logic behind it all. So I turned up and again, once more, found myself in the final. and it was up against the number one at that time, which was Margaret Hicks. And Margaret Hicks, again, was a very strong international athlete, but also had extremely good niwaza. And that was my weak point because I was still quite young and never really established myself as a niwaza athlete. And in the way the rules were in those days, I was lucky I could get away with it, really, to be honest. Nowadays, I'd most probably be crucified in the niwaza if I had that quality in niwaza as I did as a youngster. But I went on, competed against Margaret, and it was, again, I call it a bit of luck because she was an amazing athlete, and on paper, she was the number one. But I threw her for a Sio Toshi, and she went over for a Wazari, and she came back, and my goodness, did I upset her. But I managed to scrape through the whole match, running away from her and avoiding, to her frustration. And it was those days that when you were in the niwaza, you could crawl off the edge of the mat.
That's right, yeah.
She tried to crawl and drag me back in so she could completely finish me off. But I was too sharp for her to sort of fall for that trick. So I managed to win the British Championships. And from there, I just flew because I then got selected to... at 16 to go to the American Open, which was the year before the first ever Women's World Championships. And which, again, I'd only been to Germany. I'd never really been anywhere. So I was going through my exams at school and I went to the school and I said, look, I've got a chance of going to America. And I told all my friends and I was hyper about it. And I was all excited about going. I had what I thought was my name on the ticket, and there was a bit of a clerical error that they put the wrong name. The BJ at that time put the wrong name on the ticket, and someone from the BJ office phoned up my mother while I was at school to say, oh, we're sorry, I made a mistake. Loretta's no longer going to America. And by then I told everyone, all family, all friends, school friends, you name it. Literally within the week that I knew about it, but within 20, say about 5 hours a school day, my mother had been on to Charles Palmer. She'd threatened to go to the papers, you name it, to find out why they changed their mind. They weren't going to do that to my daughter, to the point that Charles Palmer came back and said, oh, I'm very sorry that there was a bit of a clerical error. And yeah, she's going now. So,
Charles Palmer, of course, at this point is chairman of BJA and indeed chairman of the IJF as well. Yeah,
that was it, an IJF. So my mum didn't care who she was speaking to, but they were going to treat their daughter. So you can see where I got my fighting spirit from. I think it was from my mother.
So at this point, the GB ladies team, the GB female team, Ellen Cobb is running this. This is prior to Roy Inman taking it on.
Well, there was a change within coaching, and to, in a way, because I was still very young and I'd always been used to having female coaches. I was very blessed that there were some very strong female judokas in those days. And you had Liz Viney that was manager. You had Ellen Cobb. There were so many. And so when that change came about, I was 15 when Roy Inman then took over. Well, I was coming up to 16 then. And he took over the women's senior team. And yes, it was a little bit strange for me because I'd always been either used to doing it on my own with my dad, taking me here, there and everywhere, or I was used to that female presence on a judo mat that I felt at that time very comfortable with. So I had to adapt and I wasn't 100% sure. And I was still very, very young as well. So that was a major change. But it's like anything that you're amongst in those days, it was the women's team. So there wasn't a mix like what we're seeing now. It's a mixed team, the men and women together, and that they unite them. And so we were fortunate in those days that it was just all women and we could express ourselves. We could push ourselves. We built up a really good sort of family as such in those days of women coming together and supporting each other and being united. And we were pioneers, which we didn't even know in those days. We were just young girls that had big ambitions to be successful in a sport that really wasn't given any credit for at that particular time. We didn't have a world championships, we had Europeans, and we were blessed to have an amazing athlete in those, and an amazing few athletes in those days like the Ellen Cobbs, but also the Jane Bridges of the world, and who was not only an amazing fighter, but she was a technician that I, again, was a role model for me. I wanted to be the next Jane Bridge. And so I idolized Jane she was a great role model because technically she was a purist. And when you watch somebody, you don't look at the fight, you look how effortless she made things. And for me, that was very attractive within judo. It was the idea that you could break up the movements and be a perfectionist in the skill rather than the fight within the person. And that's something that I really, truly admired with judokas. And those were the ones that I tend to sort of gravitate to, which was really important. And I think that those role models in my life, early stage of my life, is why I really home in on the technical aspect of a sport, because we can all fight. If we're fighters, we can fight. Naturally, we have that into us. And I'm always a great believer, you can't put in what God leaves out. So you can either fight or you can't. And you can either want to win. No one can put that into you. You've either got that grit and that determination to want to win and the confidence to believe in yourself. But what is hard and you have to truly work at, and it doesn't just happen overnight, is the technical input, the skills. You have to have the tools to be able to complete the whole circle of perfection. And for me, I was looking at that perfection at an early stage. A lucky fighter, had a bit of grit, had an idea that because I was so young, I was just, well, if I win, I win. If I lose, well, I've gained experience. I've not lost anything. It's all learning curves for me. And I was always grounded in that with my parents, because you go home and you're just one of the, you're the oldest in the family. You're just one of the family, and that's it. So although I was starting to be successful in a competitive career, I also had this sort of balance in my life that when I used to go home, it was like, well, it's your turn to do the dishes tonight because we've been doing it while you've been training.
Absolutely.
And it was that type of thing. So you just go, oh, right, okay, it's my turn then. So get back off that cloud and come down to reality. So it was good. I had a very sort of a humbling background, a very sort of a background that I at that time didn't realize was blessed to be surrounded by some very good judo people and teachers, really, because although I didn't have a coach, I was surrounded by people that were teaching me and they didn't even realize they were teaching me.
Absolutely. So at this point, obviously, you've made the British team. Like you said, you've won the British trials. You've been selected to fight, as you say, at the inaugural Women's World Championships, which we should point out, the men had a world championship since the 1950s. And there were no plans for a long, long time to give women a world championships. And you say about Pioneer and obviously women who inspired you. It was the great Rusty Kanakoji who took on, well, everybody from what I can gather, to really put that world championships together in New York, in, I believe it was in Madison Square Garden.
Yes, that's right. What an amazing place to have a world championships.
Absolutely.
When you think of the likes of Frank Sinatra, Muhammad Ali, people like this. And I remember standing in New York outside Madison Square Garden, and I was waiting every time for the flashing lights to come up saying women's first world championships. And I thought, oh, I'm part of that, 17 years of age. And thought that was just amazing, not realizing what we were achieving. And we can reflect back that it was an amazing accomplishment from Rusty Kanokoge, who was that person that really did drive it for women to be not only respected, but to be as equal within the world of a sport that should have been equal with men and women.
Yes.
And it just took a long time. But it takes somebody to make that brave step forward, and she made some really brave moves, there's no doubt about it, to the point that she pretended that she was a man fighting in a male competition to have then a medal stripped from her when they found out that she was a female. And just an amazing story. But when you get to know, and I'm really good friends with her daughter, Jean Kanokoge, but Rusty was one of these, Roy was always one of these characters that he was all tough and one of the big I am at times, a great guy. He had a lot of, he was somebody that as a person, that as an athlete that didn't have a coach, I was always felt like it was we were at loggerheads all the time. At a very young age, I was a little bit sort of stepping back because I was so used to female coaches. And then when I got to know him, I always felt that if I didn't speak up, I was going to be left behind because I didn't have a coach, which meant that it became personal at times with Roy. And although Roy was very much you do as you're told sort of thing at the early stages when we were all youngsters coming through, and Roy did have a bark, but when he said jump, we all went right how high. We just did as we were told. We knew no better, and we were very, very young to even question why he would ask us to do the things we were doing. But I remember when he met Rusty Kanokoge, well, I've never seen someone sort of shrink in front of a woman like that. And it was quite comical. Those two got on like house on fire. She loved Roy Inman. There was no doubt about it. And they had a great relationship. And I think she found him as an ally because he was doing so much in the development of women's judo in Great Britain. And we were pioneers because we were very successful, the women's judo team for Great Britain. And obviously we had Jane Bridge who won the 48th world title and was given the silver apple for going back to technician, the technician of the tournament, which was well deserved. There's no doubt about it. And so Rusty and Roy had a great relationship, and they built a sort of a stage for women to be recognized in the world of judo. But it did take a long time. We were talking 1980 was the first world championships. We then had the second one, which was in 1982, and where I took, because I fought in the first world championships at under 56 kilo category, I then went down to the weight category of the under 52s, which meant 2 years later. And the world championships are obviously now every year, but in those days it was every 2 years. So I went down to 52 kilos, but then for the draw, I wasn't seeded, which would mean that I was just thrown into the mix.
Because you had won bronze, obviously, in 1980, again, as
yes,
a 17-year-old.
Yes.
In the under 56 category, yeah.
Yeah, so I was bronze medalist, but then moving down a weight category, I was just thrown into the mix, and that was it. And Edith Horvat, who was from Austria, who was many, many times European champion, was world champion in the first ever Women's World Championships in New York, was then the one to beat. Obviously, she had fought Yamaguchi, so Kuri Yamaguchi, she fought her in the final. Again, a very young athlete from Japan, beautiful technician, great as she was, terrifying to be on the receiving end of. And she was silver medalist from the first ever Women's World Championships. So Yamaguchi was going for gold. I was praying for a good draw. And obviously, Horvat was looking to retain her title. And building up to those world championships, it was a bit of tongue in cheek, and we used to joke about it. And many a time I joked with Roy, days leading up to the World Championships when we were in Paris. And I said to Roy, I said, do you know what? Knowing my luck, I'll end up with a world champion first fight. And we used to laugh, but, you know, in the back of my mind, I thought that could happen. It could quite easily happen. And that's exactly what happened. I ended up on that draw, having Hrovat the first match. I had a bronze medalist in the quarterfinals from the previous World Championships. And then I had the silver medalist in the final.
What were your expectations going into 1982? Because, again, you had got a bronze in 1980. Were one of the realistically one of the top players in the world at this point. I mean, did you believe you could become world champion in 1982? Was it something you set out and thought, I can do this?
Well, for me, it was when I went into the first worlds. No, I didn't think I was, because I'd moved into 56. It wasn't my weight category. And I didn't expect it. But then when I got the bronze medal, I don't think we really realized what we'd done. And there wasn't much, obviously, Jane, there was a lot of exposure for Jane being the world champion, which greatly, that was wonderful. But then Neil Adams, the next year, ended up winning his world title, which again took a bit of a limelight away from the women's judo and what they were achieving at that time. And they were achieving a lot. But then going into the second World Championships, I felt stronger. I was having some good matches. I'd actually fought Edith Rovat in Austria, one of the Austrian tournaments, and had beaten her prior to the World Championships, where I remember George Kerr, who was the coach for Austria, turning around to me at that tournament, that very tournament, saying, Loretta, it would have been better you did that in the World Championships. And I went, George, that was just the warm-up. You ain't seen nothing yet.
Oh, I love it.
And I walked away because I was absolutely fuming that he thought, well, just because I've beaten her here, I'm not going to beat her at the World Championships. And for me, it was just like taking each match as it came. But when I won my first match of the World Championships, for me, because Edith Rovat was such a phenomenal athlete and had got so many titles under her, she was the one to beat. And I just knew if I lost again, I lost against the current world champion. If I won, I knew I had a big chance of winning the title. So for me, halfway through that match, and then at the end, the result was that I won that first, and it was just first round.
First round fight.
That I'd won the world title. And I remember Roy saying, that's the first round. You've got more to come. And I was like, but I've just beaten Edith. I've just beaten her. She's killed me before. I've just beaten her. So it took a bit to sort of come together. And eventually sort of got my head round the fact that I was getting closer to that world title, but I had trained so hard for. And again, that was another thing that inspired me, not the fact that Edith Rovat was, I think it was like 6 times European champion, current world champion. I just thought, I have trained so hard. And I said to somebody that turned around and went, oh, I'm really sorry, when they heard the draw. I went, do you think I'm going out first fight? That was all I was concerned about. It wasn't the fact that she was world champion. I just thought, I don't want to go out of this competition in the first round. I want to have a chance in this game, in this world championships. So I've got to get over that first match, whoever it is. And so that was my mentality going into the world.
So that must have given you confidence, though, knowing you've beaten arguably the world number one, the current world champion. You've beaten her in the first round. I mean, moving through that tournament, I imagine you must have just thought, well, I've already beaten the best, so whoever's put in front of me now.
Yeah, but I did know that there was, Edith Rovat was very good new as a technician. Tatcha wasn't the greatest. She had techniques that could get her into the ground. And if you've got into the ground with her, you're more or less it was over and done with. And I knew tactically I had to stay on my feet, because if I got into Niwaza, I knew I was going to be in trouble. And that was my plan, my action plan, was to hit and run, and just wear her down. She was a little bit more mature of an athlete than I was. So I had that energy. And it was literally, I was running on nervous energy throughout that whole match. It most probably, I've never seen the match replayed, but I could imagine it wasn't the most prettiest matches to watch. It wasn't the most technical one. But I knew the big risk was going to be Yamaguchi on the other side, who had amazing ashiwazas and was very, very dangerous on her feet. She was very similar. She didn't show too much in the niwaza, but we didn't need to see much in the niwaza because her tachiwaza was so amazing. And she was a little bit taller, long-limbed, which I used to find quite tricky as well, because they sort of overpower and overshadow me in a contest. And I always look like I'm sort of being defensive, and they seem to be always in more control. So I had that in mind, that I had to be very careful with her. And I knew one thing in that final, when I did get into the final with Yamaguchi, that the one thing I couldn't do was bounce. And that was what I kept thinking. If I bounce, she's going to sweep the feet from under me, and it's going to be over and done with. So I kept my feet pinned to the ground, and I was hitting and running all the time. Again, it was a very, very tough match. It actually went to a hand tie in that time. And in those days, a hand tie was two corner judges that would pull up the flag on who they gave it to. But there was a moment in that contest that she got the kumikata right, and she started to lift and started to bounce, and I started to skip. For a split second, I just froze, because I thought, oh, here it goes. I'm going to take a flying lesson. But I managed to sort of remind myself what the tactics were going into the contest. But it went to a hand tie, and I got it on a split. So it could have gone either way. And I always said at that time, I was never sort of in a sportsman-like way, that because she was such an amazing athlete, and she'd already had the silver medal, and now she'd had the second silver medal. But technically, I felt she was better than me. I'd still got a lot to do, although I'm saying, like, I was 19 at that time, but I still had a lot to learn. And she was such a purist. Again, I admired that in Yamaguchi. And I remember my father was there watching, and it was in the Coubertin Stadium, and it was his birthday on that day. And I went over to him and I said, "Here, Dad," I said, "happy birthday." And his first words were to me, "Oh, you were lucky." and I replied, I know. So because I was in Europe, I was in Paris, and some would say, well, is it because you need that element of luck, that you're a European fighting an Asian, and that percentage of the refereeing most probably was European. I can't even remember who the referees were on that day. But I just said it could have gone either way. It was that little bit of luck. There was nothing that could divide us other than her timing being most probably at one stage a lot better. It was like the purist against someone that was sort of rough in the edges and was just a pure fighter. And I think I won it just on my fighting spirit rather than my technical impression. But what was good is that literally about 18 months after that, I got invited to go back to the first ever All Japan for women.
And, wow.
So this was the first time they had the women competing in a big international in Japan. And I was invited, all expenses paid, to go over there. The gold medalist did. And the big thing was obviously the rematch of Yamaguchi, which was their number one player in Japan in those days. And rightly so, two silver medals under her belt, and she was looking for gold. And she could see that gold being in Japan, in her own backyard sort of thing. And I remember having this first time ever being introduced to like a type of media feast where I had this press conference. It was the only time I'd ever experienced it, is watching the Rocky films, where you had the table and you had the managers and everything, and they all lined up head to head saying who was going to beat who. And I was absolutely terrified. I'd never experienced anything like this. And Yamaguchi, although she was a year younger than me, was very confident and was saying, through a translator, was saying that I was lucky at the World Championships, and she's going to prove that, and it's her competition and she's going to win gold. And they asked me the question, was I going to win? And I just said, well, I didn't come here to lose. That's all I could say.
So it was like a pro boxing fight almost.
So it was very simple. Yeah. And Roy Inman was sitting there, and we were just gobsmacked because of the press that was there for us. It was mind-boggling. It really was. It was amazing. And it was quite nerve-wracking because we hadn't even fought at this stage. And already I'm put into a press conference talking about the match that hasn't happened yet. And when we actually both got, we were both on opposite sides. We got into the final. And yes, that was a show and a half. She threw me. In those days, we had the Yukos.
Yes.
Some people will be out there listening. We haven't lost the Yukos. They've just been named differently. So, but enough said about that politically.
Yes.
But she threw me for a Yuko. And in the first 30 seconds of the contest, and I thought, oh, no, this is not going to go right.
Yeah, I won't be getting that back.
I'm not going to get that back too quickly. And I fought and I fought, and there was a couple of times I went up again, and it was literally 30 seconds, less than a minute in the end of the contest. And I thought, well, do you know what? It's all or nothing. I'll either get thrown for 10 or I've got to give 110% here to try and get the last one in. So I fired in with, again, a Siotoshi. She went right over the top, to my surprise. She put her arm down to stop herself from going over, broke her elbow.
Oh, God.
Went over in a screaming fit of pain. And I must admit, I feel really bad even admitting it. But the first thing that came to my mind, did they score it? anybody that knows me, I feel terrible. Although I was really concerned for her, I just thought, did that actually score? I didn't get another chance anyway. That was it. The contest was over. She at that time was a Yuko up. Did they score that? And yeah, they scored it upon. But I must admit, I feel even to this day, 40 years ago, I still feel bad about thinking that, because it's not sportsmanlike and it's not me. But
How did you? I mean, just to go back again, obviously to 1982, your world champion. How did you deal with that? Because I mean, that's a lot of responsibility and pressure on a 19-year-old girl. You know, you're 19 years old. How did that change your life? How did that affect you?
I think at that time, when I became world champion, the pressure did come on. Not the pressure from out externally, but the pressure I started to put on myself, and the lack of truly understanding about preparation, periodization within programs. We were just fighters in those days. When you look at what athletes have today, as far as the team that surrounded them with the programs that periodization programs that peaks athletes so many times a year, and a strength and conditioning program that goes hand in hand with that, the medical support that they get, the psychology support, the financial support, everything that comes together to give them, to make the ultimate package of a world-class athlete. In those days, we had Roy. And we had a handful of people that were like sort of parental guidance, that were a physio. We had the thing we were blessed with, we had Dr. Ken Kingsbury.
Yes.
In those days. And he was an amazing an amazing doctor who was very supportive, world class, and he truly looked after us when we did have the serious injuries, which I did when I went on to try and retain the world title 2 years after that. And that was the reason I got injured there, and not the reason why I didn't win, but the reason I got injured was because in those days, in my mind, without having a coach, without having a club, I was still going on by the seat of my pants and doing what I thought was right. And my thought was, I trained hard to become world champion, so I'll train even harder to retain it.
Sure.
And I trained so hard and too hard that my body just, I picked up an injury at the Buddha Quay of a shoulder injury, which meant that I was actually, it was on my right side, which meant that I was trying to overcompensate to do the training, to keep the training going in preparation for the World Championships. And by the time my shoulder repaired, I'd obviously unbalanced my body and put more pressure on the other shoulder. So when I went into the World Championships, I was in the quarterfinals and I fell awkwardly. And at that time, didn't know how much damage I had done, but I had torn the ligaments in my shoulder. But I'd gone into shock and I wanted to win. And that's all I could keep thinking. I want to win. I'm in the quarterfinals. One more, it's in the semifinals. I can get there. And I continued fighting against the wishes of the physio in those days and against Ken Kingsbury. And other than throwing in a towel and coming out and getting me, they just let me go for a bit because they didn't know the extent. And we had a rule that a doctor couldn't come in, and if they touched, you wouldn't be able to carry on.
Right.
So it was one of those things. I didn't want to risk it. And it happened to Karen as well. She carried on, and then she had a horrendous break in her ankle. But it was the ruling with that. They couldn't assess anything. So you didn't know how much damage you're doing. And when you have such a serious injury, that moment, your body does go into shock. You don't know what you're doing. Your mind goes, you're in pain, but you're trying to do everything to continue because
an athlete's mentality,
telling you one thing, but your body's saying another. So I did carry on, but then I decided, because I couldn't lift the arm to throw over to grip, I decided that I couldn't grip up, so I was throwing the arm over to get a connection, to get two hands on. But then when I was throwing, I was doing the most bizarre thing, is like a koshiguruma, where I was wrapping around and my elbow kept hitting the mat. So with the ligaments gone and then the elbow making contact with the mat first, the bone came through and I totally sort of broke the shoulder and protruded the bone from the skin, which meant that that was it done. And I remember at the time the physio turning around to me and saying, "You've got to come off, Loretta, you've got to come off." And I went, "Get me out of here." It was like, it was horrendous. It was the worst thing, the worst experience of my life at that time. But Ken Kingsbury got me back home very quickly. He got me straight into the hospital, where within 48 hours I was operated on, a pin put in my shoulder, and then I was out of the game for about a year, sort of. And that was a wake-up point in my life, because I then had I realized then that I felt that I was only as good as the last medal, because it was a very, very lonely time in my life that no one contacted me.
Really?
No one contacted. I was left to get on with it. I remember I had sacrificed my education to travel the world from a 15-year-old kid, or 13 really. And then I got injured and no one picked up the phone. No one says, "How are you doing?"
Yeah.
Then my weight was replaced by somebody else. I found myself at Christmas, no money, no support, no judo family, and sitting in the checkout in Sainsbury's after traveling the world, world champion, living the life that lots of kids dream of. and with nothing, not even an education to say, well, I can go back to school.
Sure, because so you're not married. You're not married at this point.
I was 21.
Yeah.
So at 21, I had that experience that I then went back to I thought, well, now that's a learning lesson. It's a learning curve for me. It was a bit of a reality check that you can't rely on a sport, especially a sport that obviously in those days it was football, it was every other sport, athletics, but judo was really the bottom of the pile as far as a profile sporting great, and especially women's judo.
Yes.
Even more so. So I then went back to school. I qualified as a beauty therapist, believe it or not.
Right.
Yeah. Try and rip people's heads off and then try and make them up afterwards, sort of thing.
But yeah.
I was always like, even though I was a rough and tumble and I could fight like hell, but at the end of the day, I was very girly as well. I loved the idea of makeup, loved nails, I loved things like this. So I thought it was something that I thought, if I cannot go back into my sport, at least I can fall back onto a career that I will be happy in.
Sure.
And so that was the reason behind that. When I qualified, I was then fully fit to get back on the mat. And then I made a bid again to become number one in Great Britain, which was a massive achievement to do, because in those days, anybody that knows what women's judo in those days was like, to get to be number one in your weight category, to get out of the country was hard enough. And
yeah.
I had the likes of Sharon Rendell and people like that, Cheryl Peels of the world, that were all youngsters coming through that were, again, very, very strong athletes. And it wasn't going to be an easy task at all to be able to get back into the framework of being a world-class athlete. But I worked on it. It wasn't easy, I must admit. It was very challenging at times. And there was a lot of disappointments that I had to face and overcome. And but the challenge was on. And like anything, it was what really spurred me on, is being the underdog once more, with nothing to lose, everything to gain. I was already out, so what did I have to lose by just upsetting everybody and getting in there again? So it came back and swung back again to being, what was the winning ingredient when I was a youngster? Taking the pressure off with nothing to lose,
yeah,
and everything to gain and learn from. And that brought me back into the fold that I went on to become European champion after a 10-year gap,
yeah,
of becoming a double European champion. And sadly, after winning the Europeans on that year, they selected the Olympic team and I wasn't part of it. I was reserve in three weight categories, believe it or not.
Yeah, I mean,
I never got a sniff of it.
No, I mean, just obviously to cover off, the as you say, when you kind of had that time off and you came back, how did you end up? Because, you know, you say you're a girl with Irish roots who was born in London, lived in England, then moved to Scotland and represented Scotland at the 1990 Commonwealth Games. I mean, you know, I know for a fact you've got a lot of love for the Welsh as well. So you cover all parts of the UK. But how did you come to be in Scotland and representing Scotland in the Commonwealth?
Well, in 1986, the Commonwealth Games was in Edinburgh. Now, I went up to Edinburgh and fighting for England.
Right.
It was in that event that they had two in each weight category, and Sharon Rendell was in that weight as well. And this was, Sharon was one of the youngsters coming up. So I'd got myself back from injury, back into the fold, training hard. But I came back to find that there was a lot of youngsters there that were hungry for my position.
Mm.
And that wasn't going to be easy. And it was hard for me emotionally and mentally to try and get myself back up onto that sort of position. And that sense of belief as well, because my confidence had been knocked as well. And I found myself going to the Commonwealth Games a little bit half prepared, but emotionally a little bit all over the place. I wasn't sure where I was, what I was doing, what I even wanted in my life. it was one of those real challenging times from being injured and feeling that I didn't get the support that I truly deserved. And I truly deserved for the amount of effort I put in, I didn't get from the support from the BJ at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am being truly honest.
Yeah, no, of course, yeah.
So going into the Commonwealth, it was the mental preparation wasn't there. Went right. into the final and it was against Sharon, and I lost to her on a split hand tie. And from there, Sharon went to the World Championships. She got a bronze medal, and rightly so. She was hungry. She was raring to go. She wanted a chance, and she got a chance and took it with both hands and went on to being world champion as well. Yeah. But it didn't stop me, because I thought, nah, I love the challenge. Right, you've taken something from me. I want it back.
Absolutely.
I've got to have something back before I sort of hang up my competitive jacket. And there was one, I then decided, how was I going to do this? So I as well as falling in love at that time. I moved to Scotland. I then started to train in Scotland, and I loved the atmosphere. It was different to what I was used to in London. Very, very different. There was the purest in London and in England. And then you had up in Scotland, you had the hardness. You had that sort of grit that I just, at first, I thought I had the grit until I moved to Scotland. And then I found out that I was a wee pussycat when I thought I was a lion. And many a time I thought I was going to get my head ripped off in most training sessions. And they... Where in London, you're sort of put in a sort of position that, yes, you're Loretta Doyle, you've been world champion. When I went to Scotland, forget it. I was just another body that they wanted to try and murder. And being English, even more so.
Absolutely.
So it was that sort of mentality to start with. And I couldn't hide behind Billy Cusack at all. He reveled in the idea that I was having scrap after scrap after scrap. He thought that was brilliant. So it took me a while to settle in, but off the mat was a different thing. We had this lovely sort of atmosphere. Everyone was jolly. We would enjoy our judo, and I started to enjoy my judo again in a different way, in a different environment. And I felt then I had a little bit more support. Obviously, it was away from my family, but it was allowing me to grow and be me. And so although I fought for England in 86, I then went on and started to compete for Scotland, which was my only chance of trying to get past the sort of selection processes that I was struggling with when it came to Great Britain. There was a couple of times I was dropped, or there was a couple of times I was taken to one event and my rival was taken to another event so we wouldn't clash. And then there was just one opportunity coming up to the Olympic Games that I thought, I've got to try this.
Yeah.
I've got to do something different. So I decided that I'd break a little rule, and I put an entry in fighting under the banner of Scotland in a World Cup event in it was the first World Cup event in Germany.
Right.
And GB was putting a team in. They put 14 players in, and I quietly put a one-man team, which was me, in for Scotland. And they accepted it, because what they said, they didn't realise, that never stopped to think. They just knew the name, knew that I was a top player, and thought, Scotland, oh, right, there's another country. And then, obviously, someone was very, very upset that I was in the competition.
I imagine so.
And didn't realise until they rocked up to see the entry list to find my name. And at that time, I'd got married, so it was Cusack on the entry. And he was like, it isn't Loretta. It isn't Loretta. Tell me it isn't Loretta Doyle. And so he wasn't a happy bunny. But I remember, again, fighting nothing to lose, everything to gain. I wasn't selected, so what have I got to lose? I wasn't good enough to go for Great Britain, as what I thought. And we fought in the final, myself and Sharon Rendell. And yes, I did beat her, and I beat her well. But there was the pressure on Sharon because, again, what did I have to lose?
Sure.
She had everything. It's pride. And obviously there was the selections and everything for the world championships. But yes, I won. And what was funny about it was that when it came to the medal table, Scotland came on top of Great Britain because they didn't get one goal and Scotland got one goal. So it was a bit embarrassing.
There you are. Yeah, absolutely. I imagine that made interesting chatter at the BJA offices. Yeah.
Well, it was funny because I did a couple of things like that, which maybe some would say is naughty, but and others would say, good on you.
Absolutely.
Go for it. If you've got a chance, you make your own destiny. I'm a great believer. Don't wait for someone to hand it on a plate to you because it'll never happen. You've got to open those doors yourself. You've got to inspire. And you can't just wait for someone to, you can't, no one's going to do it for you. You've got to do it yourself. And otherwise, it's like anything. You just keep waiting until one day it just all goes past you. And I was too, at what I thought in those days, when you see athletes the way they are now, but with the training that we did in those days, we really had to train hard. And we didn't train sensibly. We just trained really hard. So our bodies were, at 30, 31 years of age, I retired.
Yeah.
And that, for me, that was old. But now you see athletes at 30, 31, looking brilliant. But my best years as an athlete was in my later stage as an athlete because I trained more sensibly in my preparation because I was older and I was wiser. And for me, my technique, I started to realize that it's sort of light bulb moment. These youngsters, I can't stand up with them in the tachiwaza because they're going to run circles around me. I don't seem to have the same energy or condition as these youngsters have. So I've got to finish this. I've got to do something that's going to get them in the niwaza, and I've got to finish them off before time. So it was only at the latter stage of my career that did I really develop my niwaza.
Yeah.
I thought, this is a better option for me. It's the only way I'm going to beat some of them. The likes of Sharon, that is the only way I was going to beat them.
Yeah.
Because then stand up with them and they would just run circles till I got exhausted. So I started to be a much more sort of overall athlete with tachiwaza and niwaza. But it did take a long time to figure that one out, I must admit.
So if we can come to the now, so the Olympics, just for those of the people that don't know, for the men, it debuted in Tokyo in 1964. It missed 1968, but returned in 1972 and has been a staple ever since. For females, there was a test event in Seoul in 1988, which obviously doesn't go towards official totals, although Britain did fairly well in that. So the first opportunity for girls, ladies, females was 1992. Now, obviously, you were part, we covered earlier, you said you were part of a golden generation. You know, there were many, many world champions, you know, yourself, Karen, Jane, Anne, very, you know, lots and lots of world champions. Obviously, you didn't make the team. You mentioned you were reserved for three weights. And as it turns out, you, I believe in a pre-screening, you found out you were pregnant. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
I've never forgotten.
No, absolutely. But I mean, in reality, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or, but can you tell me, you know, obviously you didn't know you were pregnant when you first found out you weren't selected. And as you've said that you felt you should have been on that team. I mean, I've read quotes from you that said at the time that you were angry and not happy that you weren't included with that 92 Olympic team. Is that fair?
Yes, I just felt I had battled quite a long time with Roy Inman at that time. And it's not taking it away from Sharon Rendell, who did go instead of me. I just didn't get possibly the same opportunities, and it was, and the margin between us was so small, it was unbelievable. And the same year of the Olympics, we had the World Cup, which I had beaten her and beat her well. And then she pulled out of the European Championships 2 years on a trot leading up to those Olympic Games. And the first time when she pulled out, I got the silver medal against Jessica Gao on a split hand tie. Yeah. And then the next year in 92 Olympic year, it was myself and Jessica Gao once more in the final of the European Championships. And again, it was one of those situations. The way the match was going was identical to the year before. And I thought, well, do you know what? I don't want a deja vu. I don't want a Groundhog Day. I just want to say, right, I gave it all. And by having that sort of thought process in my head, caution to the wind, threw her. And again, a bit of luck. She put her head up to go, what was that all about? Left her neck exposed. And I decided to get my win with the shimmywaza. And she wasn't going to give up easy. She did go unconscious at the time. But yeah. Again, it was another naughty moment. Have they scored upon? But at that time, I just thought that's a chance. But I became European champion. And then the next day they announced the Olympic team, and the team that was at the Europeans, except for Sharon Rendell, because she wasn't in that European team, all went down to the Budokai where they had the press release to announce the Olympic team, which was that European team, going to Barcelona. And I was on the next flight back up to Scotland. Billy, obviously, my husband at the time, was part of that team.
Yes, he was.
So he had to go directly down to London, and I had to go directly back up to Scotland with a gold medal in hand and no Olympic place. But I didn't give up, and I was still determined I was going, because I was reserve in three weight categories. So I was always a great believer. It's never over until they're on that plane, they've got their tickets, and they've gone. And I really kept to try. I tried to keep very positive, but it was another sad experience, because that team was announced and there was only one person, I can honestly say, and that picked up that phone and asked me how I felt.
Right.
And that was Colin McIver.
Colin McIver, yeah.
He was the only person within that period of time that I actually picked up the phone and went, hi, Loretta, how are you doing? Because he would have known. I would have absolutely. Yeah. It was a difficult time, because it was a bittersweet. It was delightful that Billy had got selected for the Olympic Games. I was so proud for him to do that. It was an absolute pride. But then there was that other flip side that I didn't get to go.
Of course.
And, but then my daughter came along afterwards, and it was a situation that I focused so much. I then realized when I wasn't going to the games, that was my last international event.
I had
a lot of injuries. Every morning you wake up and you feel like you've done 10 rounds with Teddy Riner. It's one of those situations, and I just thought my body is just saying, look, it's had its day. And another 4 years for an Olympic Games, it was the only thing that I was looking for. It was just too far away for me to think it was going to be achievable. So I then, it was nice to finish and say, right, I've become European champion. That's me done. I've done it. And I'm proud of that moment. I couldn't have done any more. I did everything I possibly can do. And I was proud of that. So I wasn't angry. It was sad the way it happened, but I wasn't angry, because there were so many other nice things happening in my life that balanced up my feelings at that time. So I then went on to, I'm a great believer, when one door opens and that, when one door shuts on you, another door opens. So for me, that was the starting of another career. And that's when I went from, after giving birth to my daughter, Jade, and I then went into national coaching with the cadet squad for girls, which the cadets and the junior squad jobs that I worked as a national coach for GB were most probably the most wonderful time of my whole career in judo. I loved working. They were challenging. They made me grey very early. I'm quite sure of that. It made me realise the responsibilities of being a mum, not just for one daughter that I'd just given birth to, but for possibly in those days where there were large squads, like 100 girls that I was like not Absolutely. Only coach, but I was mum to, that I took the responsibility of every one of those girls to make sure when they were on my watch, they went yeah. home the same way they came to that squad training. So my development was very slow as far as a coaching, because they were so young, these young athletes. It was about an experience of life, because what I had learned in my own career as an athlete, there were certain parts of that that I would never have wanted another athlete to experience. And I made a promise to myself that I would never want an athlete to feel that they didn't have that phone call and yeah. how they're doing. And
yeah.
how, if they had the injury, picking up the phone and saying, yeah. are you okay? Because it more so now, because the pressure that is on these athletes is immense. When you yeah. think the last Olympic Games and these athletes have had to go through a roller coaster of emotions.
Yeah.
through a COVID pandemic where we don't know how people's lives are going. I lost my mother a year ago in that COVID period, which was yeah. very, very challenging. Yeah. There's people that have had COVID. There's people that have lost loved ones through COVID. There's athletes that have been isolated and left on their own devices to with their thought process to deal with, and the fear that they may not get to that Olympic Games. Those years of preparation with no light at the end of the tunnel, knowing where they're going to, whether they're going to get there or not. And I can't even stop to think of how they have felt. And it's amazing that not one, that they get to the games, that especially our British athletes, that they get there and qualify, but they performed well. And we got in Chelsea, got her bronze medal. And again, when you think of the journey even Chelsea had made, you'd be like, if everyone knew the whole story, you'd be amazed that she made it there and not only got a medal and a Paralympic. So proud of those guys. It's untrue. But all those athletes, to get to those games, you've got to say, what an achievement.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. So anybody that's out there sort of thinking, well, we could have done better. Well, do you know what? Under such a challenging 2 years, I think we've got to be very proud of our team.
And absolutely. Yeah,
it's one of those things, but I think it's a difficult one to judge. But what we have to do is celebrate that our athletes went there. They did as well as no athlete goes to any tournament. And this is based on my own experience. There's no athlete that will ever go to a tournament wanting to lose. They all go to win. So we've got to be sensitive to that. That it's not all. We're living in a world of judo now that the levels are so high.
Yeah.
The expense is there. It's so, so difficult. Our world, where before it was such a massive world to try and get across the continent for these events, we are just on the doorstep of talent every day, and it's hard. It's there's no doubt about it. It's hard. I'm not saying that we can't achieve it. I think we can. I think we've just got to look at it in a different way. We've got to be more adventurous. We've got to be thinking outside the box. I think yeah. there's ways that we can do it. The one thing that we have to do is that we have to do it collectively, because it isn't just one person that's got all the answers. It isn't one person that's going to be our person that's going to be the one that we put on the pedestal as the glory of British judo. We collectively, whether it's clubs and personal coaches, national coaches, area coaches, we have to work together in a way that we can find unity to be able to be what I feel great.
Yeah.
And under such challenging circumstances, it's not easy. It's easy to have an opinion, but it's not so easy to try and put those opinions into action. And I think we can do it, but we have to talk to each other and we have to collectively become champions. But we have to champion it all. We can't do it. We can't expect somebody to, like, I go back to achieving what I have achieved. We can't expect people to do it for us. We've got to play our part in achieving these goals. And if we sit back and say it's not my bag, and then it's the wrong attitude, because we've all got, we can learn from each other, and for me it's the way forward.
Loretta, why do you think, after you say obviously your competitive career came to an end, I mean, many sports people, not only in judo, you know, their competitive career comes to an end, and they move on to a different part of their life. But you chose to stay in judo. You've been in judo, as you say, for is it over 50 years now? Probably.
Hey, cheeky.
Oh, sorry.
It's still under 50.
It's still under 50.
Just under.
I mean, in that time, like you said, you know, you spent 12 years, I believe it was, as the national coach for cadet and junior. You have been a BJJ board of director. You're currently a BJJ board of director, obviously. You've been involved in IJF commissions. You've been, obviously, I thoroughly enjoyed your commentary on the IJF tournaments. You're an eighth dan. You know, I mean, again, I mean, and this is the tip of the iceberg. Why? So I guess what I'm asking is, why did you decide that you were going to make judo your life as opposed to a part of your life that some other people do?
Judo is who I am today. Without judo, I don't know what I would have done in my life. It has exposed me to education, to a world that would have most probably been non-existent for us. It has built my confidence up. For someone that struggled at school because of being dyslexic, I was type of person that withdrew and not went out there. But I found something. I found a sport like judo that put me on a platform that I could express myself. I could feel confidence. It gave me a sort of a pathway and a journey that, why wouldn't you have been doing something that it makes you happy? And I've always found, although I've had some difficult situations within as a competitor, and I'm not the only one, there's a lot of athletes there that have to overcome circumstances and emotional things in their life, but it definitely always outweighed by the happiest times and the people that I, over the years, when I think from when I started judo, I now mix in circles, and like the areas that you say with the international judo, the British judo, working as one of the board of directors, it's one of those situations. I remember them. They're like old friends. They used to be like your kohai senpai thing. You looked up to them as sort of your peers, and then you found as the years go by, you're getting or looking just as old as them, and they're still there. And you just got to, for me, it's about what I celebrate in the sport is that they've got so many nice people in it. There is it draws so many nice people into our sport. And for me, why wouldn't you be in that environment? It's like wrapping yourself around like a big comfort blanket. And I enjoy that. And what I enjoy is when I liked as a national coach, it was seeing people grow, young adults growing to young women who now, when I look back on Facebook and I'm doing the nosying bit, they've got their families, clubs, or they're business women. And it was never, as a national coach, it was never about the medals.
Yeah.
It was about the women they were becoming. And I feel that if I did anything successful, is that I brought a bunch of girls together that to this day are friends.
Yes.
They are mothers. They are families that has extended into a judo family. And that's what I'm proud of. I'm proud of that. It's not about the results, because the results come and go. The medals are just medals, but it's the person within and how you grow. And I feel that that's what judo has done for me. It's kept me grounded. It's given me a huge amount of confidence. It's given me a huge amount of friendship within it, and something that I don't see going away. It'll always be in my blood. And because it's like a magnet, all this is drawn. And I have a real urge to always give back into a sport that has given me so much. And that's important to me. And hence the reason when I go internationally, I get ticked off now and again when I'm doing the commentary, that I can't help but sit on the edge of my seat when Nakoda or Sally Conway comes on, or the Chelsea Giles has come on. I'm like biting my fingernails and cringe and sort of hanging on dear life to the thigh of Neil Adams, to his screaming pain at times, edging these players to do so well. But it's there. It's in my heart. It's in my gut. And I believe in my sport. I believe in the people in it. Hence the reason that I just want to stay focused on the true values of the sport, because I think sometimes we can get upset with what things are happening. And yeah, we may not all agree with some of the directions. And yes, that's very frustrating for me too. But I still hang on to the sense of, if I'm in there, I can do something about it. I can voice people's opinions. And that's why I say actively involved, because judo's put me on a pedestal. And rather than doing it, it's not about doing it for myself, because what am I doing for it? Because there's no end there for me. It's not as if it's making me loads and loads of money. It ends up costing me loads and loads of money. But it's because I think people have put me up there, and I've got a duty of care to looking after them that have given me that voice, that have given me that platform to try and bring everything up with me and take it forward. So that's why I stay in it. My son's heavily involved in it. I don't know if I liked that at the beginning. He was a good hockey player. And I don't know if my nerves can cope with every time he competes. That's a very challenging bit. But the rest of it, I love it. Absolutely love it. And I love it because I love the people in it and the true values of the sport. And that's where I always say to people, when they have a hard time, go back to where, ask the question to yourself, why do you get upset, and why do you stay actively involved in the sport? And at the end of the day, we have one thing in common. We're passionate. Well, a couple of things. We're passionate about the sport collectively. We love our sport and we all want it to be successful.
Well, I think, absolutely, Loretta. Look, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. As I mentioned at the beginning, these podcasts and transcripts are really to record the people involved within our sport that we love so much, and to get their history and their thoughts. And if I could just pay tribute to you at the end of this podcast, the father of British judo, Gunji Koizumi, who famously founded the Budokai in 1918, like I say, known as the father of judo. I would say that you're the mother of judo, definitely. you mentioned about the girls you've coached, I'm of a generation, I'm 41 now. So I have friends who are my age who trained underneath you, and, all of them always pay tribute to that part of your personality, the fact that you were that caring, and you were looked after them and gave them advice. And not only, on some of them, I've spoken to, have said it wasn't only judo advice. It was life advice. It was, advice about being a young female who, you know, had found herself in a situation where she was, you know, an international, and you'd lived through that. And yes, I've been told of stories where you were sort of waddling around when you were pregnant, and you know, and I think that adds to it. That just adds to the whole thing. So look, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And like I say, this is and hopefully anyone who you know, any young player that comes across this will take time to listen and hopefully take on board the advice you've given. So thank you very much for your time, and I'll see you very soon. And I would advise anyone else who, if they see the competition, go up and have a chat with Loretta, because she's always keen to hear about judo stories from anybody of any age and any ability. So yeah, thank you, Loretta. Thank you for this evening.
Oh, thank you very much. That's it's been a pleasure. And to any, yeah, and take that advice on board. Anyone that sees us, oh, I just love to chat. Chat too much, most probably a lot of the time, but.